Just so everybody should know that with Pesach coming up, I think we're going to take off a little bit after this week. So we'll go on Pesach break, and in Yetz Hashem we'll resume after Pesach, not the first Thursday after Pesach, and in Yetz Hashem the following Thursday after Pesach. So that will be, everybody should be back from wherever they're going away to, for those who are going away. That will be Thursday, April 27th. So we're going to take a bit of a hiatus, we'll call it our Pesach break. Yes?
My father's yahrzeit is tomorrow night. Can we share tonight with Zecher from my father?
Absolutely. So the learning tonight should be Zecher Iloi Nishmas.
Rafael
Yehuda Hirsch. Ben Yitzchak.
Thank you.
One of the vodka. Okay. Sure. Why not? No. Surprising. Okay. So we were talking about some of the procedural issues, and we spoke about secular courts getting involved in choosing and picking a bezdin. We discussed the Powell versus Powell case about how a secular court is not supposed to convene a rabbinic tribunal. I told you my own experience where sometimes a secular court will convene a rabbinic tribunal, and it's not necessarily always such a bad thing. But now let's talk about some of the nitty-gritty regarding some of the other procedural policies of the Bez, and they have to be put into place. So we mentioned about Shtari Beruin, that one of the key ingredients of a successful arbitration proceeding, whether it's in Bezdin or in a different arbitration forum, is for the parties to sign an arbitration agreement. And we call that a shtar beruin in halacha, and it coincides with the secular law requirement of an arbitration agreement. Sure. Technically speaking, in order to be mekabel kinyan, in order to accept upon oneself an obligation in halacha, one typically, like in a chassan's tish, would pick up a handkerchief. And I think I mentioned to you that I have these handkerchiefs, so I brought one. Handkerchief, okay, take a look. Okay, you can see the Indian sheep over here. So this is the standard official Beis Din approved Kenyan soother instrument effectuate binding commitments from the parties in front of the Beis Din. So why isn't that enough? So there are several reasons why it also makes sense to sign a shtar beruin. And I'm going to mention really six of them. So one reason we find in the first source here in the Gemara Bava Metzia, we mentioned quickly, Daf Chof Amud Aleph, if there is no Beis Din Kavua in the city and the parties have to specifically choose a particular dayanim to hear the case, as in a Zabla proceeding where each side picks one dayan and the two dayanim pick a third dayan. So, or if there's no Beis Din Kavua and they just want to say we want to go in front of the CRC Beis Din as opposed to a different Beis Din in town. So that's evidenced, even according to halacha, by the signing of an arbitration agreement. Once the parties sign an arbitration agreement called a Shtar Beruin, they can no longer retract from their choice of Beis Din. So it gives jurisdiction to a particular Beis Din. You look in source number two, which is Hilchos Dayanim in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Yud Beis, as Sif Zayin, talks about how when there is some type of a kinyan, and this can presumably be done through the handkerchief as well, when the parties are mekabel kinyan, then if they are giving the Beis Din the authority to decide the case according to principles of pshara, of equity and compromise and settlement, as opposed to a strict letter of the law judgment, what we call Yikov Adin Sahar, let the law pierce the mountain. Like the Gemara Bava Metzia says that Yerushalayim was destroyed because everybody insisted on the strict letter of the law, below Asul Lifnim Mishir Sedin, and they didn't want to resolve their cases through settlement, through pshara. So in order for the parties to authorize the Beis Din to impose a decision based on pshara principles upon them, they could be mekabel kinyan, and says the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama says, Hu adinim nasan shtar alav. This is also true. If they sign a contract, they sign a document in which they agree that the case shall be adjudicated through pshara. So that's a second purpose that the shtar beruin serves, so that even if they were not mekabel kinyan, they didn't pick up the handkerchief, but once they sign the arbitration agreement, that gets the job done as well, to accept a pshara-imposed judgment. I want to clarify, because sometimes there's confusion about pshara. Pshara, since it's often translated as settlement, So people often think that means simply that Bezdin will sit with the parties and facilitate a mediation and get the parties to agree upon an amicable resolution. I just spent a couple of days in another city working on a mediation with parties. They weren't interested at the time in a din Torah, in signing an arbitration agreement for various reasons, and they wanted us to try to mediate the dispute. So I flew down to this place and I sat with the parties for a couple of days, and Baruch Hashem, we were able to work out some type of a mediated settlement. So that certainly is one aspect of what we mean when we speak about pshara, that it's a mitzvah for the parties to make a pshara, to try to work out a resolution amongst themselves, and sometimes that will even be facilitated through the Beis Din involvement and intervention. But when we speak about pshara in the context of a signed arbitration agreement, what that means is that the parties are authorized things in the Beis Din to say that even in the event that the parties themselves are not able to agree upon an amicable resolution, even if the Beis Din tried to recommend an amicable resolution and one or both parties that didn't want to go along with it, that the Beis Din then retains the authority and the power to impose a settlement upon the parties, to say to the parties, you didn't want to settle, but we're going to impose a settlement upon you. Even though this settlement might not be in accordance with strict rules of Jewish jurisprudence, and maybe we'll be giving one side a little bit more and the other side a little bit less than what they otherwise would have received according to strict law. Nonetheless, we have that right and that ability to impose this court-ordered settlement upon the parties. That's what we mean when we say that the parties agree to sign on the dotted line to give the Beis Din the authority to decide according to pshara. Yes?
To rephrase that a different way, isn't that basically an agreement by the parties that whatever the Beis Din decides is appropriate, is appropriate?
100%. But it's giving the, but it's giving a certain jurisdictional mandate to the Beis Din to decide in accordance with what we deem halakhic principles of pshara. And nowadays, the Beis Din doesn't generally ask for the authority to decide according to general pshara, because parties are sometimes afraid that means the Beis Din will just split the baby in half in every single case, but the Beis Din asks for authority to decide in accordance with pshara krova ledin, what we call equitable principles that are aligned to what the legal outcome of the case should be. So the Beis Din might determine that according to legal principles, Reuven is entitled to $1,000, but they'll make a pshara, they'll adjust it a little bit, and the pshara can be adjusted up until, according to many authorities, one-third or so, that they can adjust it, you know, to and there's a basis for this from various Gemaras that talk about this being an amount which is within the ballpark of what the judgment ought to be, like Demei Basar Bizol. There's a Gemara in Baba Kama that talks about that. You sell the meat for like a little bit of a discount from what it would have been otherwise, or you evaluate it a little bit of a discount, and that's evaluated as a one-third differential. So that's often the benchmark that the Batei Din utilize. Now what happens though, very often when you're doing a mediation, let's say a Beis Din is going to sit down with the parties and try to mediate a dispute. So a mediation is a little bit hamish, it's a little bit informal, and sometimes the parties will even throw out settlement offers that they wouldn't necessarily have offered in open court if the case was going to be litigated. So the mediator is privy to all kinds of information, sometimes confidential information. Part of the mediation might be shuttling back and forth between the different sides and engaging in ex parte communications, which is not normally the way in which an arbitration is supposed to be conducted. So does it make sense then for that individual, that Dayan of the Beis Din who had engaged in the mediation process, that they'd say, okay, the mediation didn't work out, but I remember that you offered this amount and you offered that amount, and therefore on the basis of these various offers that were offered in the context of mediation, I'm going to now impose a pshara through the mechanism of arbitration. So generally speaking, that's not something that the parties would have a comfort level with, because when dealing with a mediator, parties will be much more open and will be much more willing to do things that they wouldn't be willing to do if they had to resort to a strict arbitration decision that was going to be imposed upon them. So what we do in cases in which we're going to transition, or convert a case from a mediation to an arbitration is that we will generally appoint somebody else to hear the arbitration, to be the judge, so to speak, to impose the decision upon the parties, a different person than the person who had been involved in the mediation, who's privy to all of this other information that would not typically have been offered in the context of an arbitration. So the way in which this process is brought about is usually through the signing of a med-arb agreement. This is a special type of shtar beruin. It's not a shtar beruin which is simply authorizes the Besdin to engage in arbitration, but it's a shtar beruin that says we authorize the Besdin to engage in mediation, and in the event that the mediation doesn't work out, so then we agree to have this case converted from a mediation to an arbitration, and typically at that point in time the dayan will be changed. And now, I have had the experience a couple of times in which the parties were just so pleased with their interactions with the mediator in question. It might have been me, it might have been somebody else, which they've said, okay, now that it has to go to arbitration, we really have a level of trust. We weren't able to work it out, you know, with you together, but we trust you that you'll be able to figure out what is best for us, so we will abide by whatever you impose upon us. And then they give their waiver, that they waive any objections to any ex parte communications that may have taken place, and they give that authority to the arbitrator. But that would have to be a very specifically agreed upon by the parties after the mediation process had been completed. Because you can't really waive their right before you engage in the mediation, since the parties don't really know how they're going to feel after the mediation process has been completed. So that's the second function that a shtar beruin could potentially play. A third is that there's a concern on some level that there are certain things that a shtar, a contract, can't typically do. Like when it comes to acquisitions, we say that a shtar has the ability of transferring real estate, for example. So if parties are arguing about real estate and they want to say, well, we'll agree that whoever the Besdin rules that the property should go to, the property will then go to that person. So that can all be written down in a shtar, because a shtar, a contract, has the ability, according to Torah law, to effectuate a transfer of real property. But a shtar doesn't have the ability to effectuate a transfer of movable property, for example. So if parties sign a shtar, so what then creates the kinyan if the Besdin's they're going to say at the end that we're going to rule that a certain piece of a movable property has to be transferred by Reuven to Shimon, or a certain amount of money has to be paid from Reuven to Shimon. So how is that going to be accomplished through the shtar? So that's another good reason why you should have the kinyan suder, so which kinyan suder certainly can be good for the transfer of a movable property and obligations. So the Sma, if you look at source Gimel over here, this is Simen Yud Beis Sif Zayin Sif Katan on Simen Yud Beis Sif Zayin in the Shulchan Aruch, Sif Katan Yud Ches in the Sma. So the Sma says that in certain cases, even a haschayvus, an obligation, is something that can be undertaken through a written contract. And he says like this. He says that imnasim. That one of the chidushim of the Ramah, when the Ramah says that you can make a kinyan on pshara, that a person can enter into a binding obligation to follow the Besdin's ruling through a signed contract. Maram Kamash Mulan Khan, the Ramah is teaching us that also, even if the person doesn't know what the ultimate amount of money is going to be, that's going to be imposed by the Besdin as a settlement, if a person utilizes a phraseology in the arbitration agreement in the shtar beruin, which is a lashon chiyum, which they say they're taking upon themselves as a binding obligation to abide by the ruling of the Besdin, eno yako laksobo, then they are not allowed to retract from that obligation. And the shtar would say, areini chayav lach atzach kach v'kach, we're arguing about a certain amount of money, whatever the Besdin is going to decide, I hereby obligate myself. Now this is very interesting, because it actually tracks the language that is recommended and in certain states required in order to enter into a binding arbitration agreement, that it generally has to say in an arbitration agreement that the parties take upon themselves through a binding commitment to abide by the decision of the arbitration tribunal. So the halacha is very similar. The halacha says that, if you have that language in the Shtar Beruin, that the parties say that they agree to bind themselves to abide by the Beis Din's decision and to take upon themselves the obligations imposed by the Beis Din. You use that type of language there. The parties agree to a binding obligation to abide by the decision of the Beis Din. So then that enables the shtar itself, the arbitration agreement itself, to be mechayev, to obligate the parties to have to pay all of these amounts, even if it's not real estate, even if it's movables, even if it's an amount of money, as long as it has this lashon chiyuv. So that's why if you look at the standard form arbitration clause that Bati Din insert in their contracts, so they will generally have this type of language of a binding commitment.
Does that mean an upper limit here?
Well, that's an interesting question. So from the lashon, from the language of the Sma, it would appear that it is generally advisable to write what the anticipated amount of the obligation or maximum amount of the obligation could be, because that's good. So the party is clearly taking upon themselves whatever that amount is. Like, so you would have to say that the parties are arguing about a $1 million dispute, and they agree that they will accept this obligation to whatever degree it is imposed upon them by the Beis Din. Now, in truth, generally speaking, the Shtar Beruin does not have a specific amount which is is articulated. And the question then arises, well, then why is that considered to be good enough? So that brings us to the fourth benefit of the shtar, which is discussed by a dayan from Eretz Yisrael. His name is Rav Yoezer Ariel. He wrote an article about the utility and purpose and benefit of the Shtar Beruin in the Tuchumin Journal. We have it here in the bookshelves, I believe. It's volume Yud Dalet, 14. If you want it, it's right there. And the colorful volumes over there on the second to the top shelf of one of the different rows in the bookcase. In the middle row over there, right. So it's Yud Dalet. I don't need to look at it right now, but you could take it off the shelf if you'd like. So Rav Yoezer Ariel says that one of the mechanisms through which transactions become binding nowadays is, even if it would not otherwise have been valid as a matter of halakha, is what we call situmta. What's situmta? That's described in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, I think the Ayin Dalet. Situmta is when there is a custom among merchants to transfer property by just like making a mark on barrels or something like that, and that causes a transfer of property. If that is the understanding of the merchants, that works as a matter of halakha. Why? Because that's the general custom. Another common form of situmta, which is described by the poskim, and even constitutes one of the explanations of the Gemara as well, is a handshake. That even though the halacha doesn't provide that there's some sort of a notion that like you can transfer something through giving over money or through a shtar, through a contract, or through a chazaka, taking active possession of the property, we don't have a notion, according to strict biblical sources or even strict Talmudic sources, that one can effectuate a transfer of property through a handshake. Nonetheless, says the Gemara, if this is the custom of the merchants, that this is how you enter into a binding commitment, so then that would be effective as well. So therefore, he says that since we live in a society where you can just look at arbitration statutes, where once there is a signed arbitration agreement, that creates an effective obligation for people to abide by whatever is decided by the arbitration tribunal, that whatever verdict is issued must be carried out by the parties. It effectuates a transaction of sorts according to the custom of the society in which we live. So therefore, it works through the mechanism of situmta. So once you have sort of the basic ingredients of a halakhic obligation according to halakha, even if you're relying to a certain degree on just what is the understanding in the marketplace of what it means when you say you take upon yourself as a binding obligation that you're going to abide by the decision of the Beis Din, even if it does not enunciate a specific amount, you can rely, says Rav Ariel, you can rely on this notion of situmta as well. So that's another very important purpose that is effectuated by the Shtar Beruin that you would not necessarily have been able to accomplish just through the Kinyan Sudor alone. Yes.
So no one says that Hefker, Beis Din Hefker, is good enough you have to make a kinyan. Bezdin doesn't have the power to say that the $100,000 that Reuven owes, it's now no longer Reuven's money. So Bezdin doesn't have the power through Hefker Bezdin Hefker to make effectuate that transfer.
Not necessarily, because Hefker Bezdin Hefker is first of all limited to, you know, certain cases where Chazal said Hefker Bezdin Hefker, where, you know, it gave Bezdin that specific, you know, authority. And secondly, there's a big dispute within Hefker Bezdin Hefker as to what degree it works. This is a dispute between the Tzos and the Nesivos, and it's a dispute between many, many Rishonim as well. When we say Hefker Bezdin Hefker, does that mean that Bezdin has the ability to take Reuven's property and to declare it ownerless? Or does it also mean that Bezdin has the ability to take Reuven's property and to hand it over to Shimon? So some say Hefker Bezdin Hefker only means that Bezdin has the ability to take Reuven's property and to declare it ownerless, but not to take Reuven's property and to transfer it over to Shimon. So therefore there's a question as to the scope of the principle of Hefker Bezdin Hefker. Okay, now, yes.
This concept of Sifukta that the Gemara talks about, where, you know, cultural formality is, you know, kind of minhag amakom, can be used to show contract or opinion or whatever. Can you reverse that also and say that the formalities that the local law requires also would apply? So, for example, I agreed to sell Ari my house, and we talked about it, we shook on it, but we never wrote it. And then I would say, I could come and defend, he could come to enforce the contract, and I could say no, because it was a should have been in writing pursuant to the statute of frauds. It wasn't in writing. It's the law of the land that it had to be in writing. Would that same concept apply?
It's a different concept. That's the concept of Dina de Malchus Adina, which we discussed at length, right? Situmta is a different kind of concept of when I have a kinyan, I have a form of transaction which would not have worked according to halacha, but it works according to the secular marketplace. So do I recognize that as a binding and an effective transaction? That's a different question. Well, I mean, your question has legitimacy, but it's just in a different category. It's in the category of Dina de Malchus Adina. Okay.
What's
yes.
The mechanism of
The Sma's mechanism, you mean, how does Hiskaibus work? How does Hiskaibus work? So Hiskaibus works, again, through this notion of a kinyan. In halacha, I can be Mekai myself. The Rambam talks about this, that I have the ability, it's like a Hodas Baldin kind of thing, that I, it's like, I have the, some say, you know, maybe it works Midin Ne'manus, that I'm believed to say when I owe you something, even if there's no consideration or evidence that I really owe you, or it could work Midin Neder, it could work as kind of like a vow, that I'm taking a vow that I agree that I'm going to pledge this amount of money to you one way or another, but the idea is that in halakha we don't require consideration. This is one difference between halakha and say secular law. In secular law, when you draft a contract, so every lawyer knows, you got to start saying for good and valuable consideration, this, the rescinding sufficiency of which is acknowledged by both parties, you know, the parties hereby agree as follows. You have to have that recitation that you have good and sufficient consideration, because otherwise one major challenge to any contract is there wasn't consideration. That it was not a tit for tat. And halakha, you don't need a tit for tat. If I get up and I say that I owe you $1 billion and I make a kinyan and I owe you $1 billion, guess what? I owe you $1 billion. I owe you $1 billion. I have to make a clear sign in Esmachta. I have to say I owe you $1 billion right now, that it's not based on any kind of a contingency whatsoever, but I can do that. So the chiddush of the Sma is that not only can I do this through a kinyan sudar, but I can even do this through a kinyan shtar, that I have the ability to do that in writing as well, and it's also evidences the same concrete intention and commitment.
Now, does that affect, once the Bezdin decides that you owe, that Reuven owes Shimon $150, whatever it is, does that affect the transfer in and of itself, or do they have to have a separate action of transfer?
The Bezdin, technically speaking, would have the right to go into Reuven's wallet and to take out the money, or to go into Reuven's bank account and to marshal his assets, or to garnish his wages, or to do any of these things. But in practicality, Bezdin doesn't have that ability. We get arrested if we did that. So we don't. So therefore, that's why we have to utilize the secular court system to be the shoterim, to be the police enforcers, to do that sort of thing. It just, we don't, you know, we have to recognize our limitations. Yes.
So, and your example of $1 billion, if they took that to a secular court to enforce, would the secular court enforce that?
Probably not. Probably not. That's an interesting question. If it was $1 billion, the secular court might say that it's a little bit too much. But if it was within, in other words, the secular court does have a standard in terms of the enforceability of judgments. The standard is that it has to not shock the conscience. So the question is, where would they draw the line in terms of something that would shock the conscience? Now, bear in mind that when you have a Besdin proceeding, generally speaking, there will be kind of a rational, reasoned analysis that will be provided as to why the Besdin is obligating this amount. It's not going to be arbitrary, but the mechanism halakhically that enables the decision to be binding based on the person's initial commitment is based on the notion halakhically that a person can just make an arbitrary commitment to have to pay money even if they don't actually owe it. When it comes to secular court enforcement, they're not relying upon that. That's what we may be relying upon halakhically. They're relying upon the fact that there's a signed arbitration agreement, which is sufficient for their purposes, and a judgment which rationally seems to make sense based on the circumstances of the case. All right? Now, the fifth function.
Sorry,
yes.
One more question. Okay. What about I make a kinyan to do something that may be enforceable in halakha, but may not necessarily be enforceable in second law? So, for example, I make a kinyan, I'm going to give XYZ tzedakah $10,000. It's a gratuitous promise. I'm simply not there or anything. It's a gratuitous promise, so it may not be enforceable at law. But let's say I made a kinyan, so it's theoretically enforceable.
It's fine. If you submitted the dispute to Besdin and you gave Besdin the ability to decide according to principles of Jewish law, and a court made the determination that this seemed reasonable according to principles of Jewish law, and I don't think in that case it would be something that a court would say shocks the conscience. A person donated $10,000 to charity, pledged $10,000 to charity, and the Besdin's requiring them to satisfy that pledge, I think it's very likely that the court would uphold the decision in such a case.
Even though it's a gratuitous promise.
That's correct, because the parties agreed to be governed according to Jewish law, and it's not a decision that shocks the conscience, you know, as an objective matter. Maybe if the person had agreed to give $1 trillion, that would be a different story, right? Well, it's a good question. So the next thing is that even let's say that a person signed a shtar, they signed the contract and it was a real estate dispute. And a shtar does have the ability in and of itself to transfer property based on a real estate, you know, dispute. And you could say that maybe a kinyan sudar, you know, maybe could have done, you know, the same. But a shtar also is more powerful insofar as if it's signed by witnesses, so then there's an additional halakhic provision that if a person had encumbered assets, or the person had assets at the time in which they entered into their obligation with the other party, and then they sold the assets to other individuals who are called lekuchos, so those assets are now considered to be encumbered according to halakha because there were witnesses who signed the shtar, and now the plaintiff, if the plaintiff prevails in his or her suit, would have the ability to go after the encumbered assets once it's signed by witnesses. That's not something you can accomplish with a kinyan sudor alone, so he mentions that as another benefit. And in fact, we generally do have witnesses sign the arbitration agreement. And finally, so those are the five considerations with respect to a shtar beruin. So then you can ask the question, so if the shtar beruin really accomplishes everything that we need to accomplish, so why do I bring in my handkerchief? Why do we have the parties then sit around the table and accept upon, you know, lift up this handkerchief in sort of this quaint, you know, ritual that is performed before the Besdin? And why do we not just rely upon the shtar beruin? So I think that the answer is twofold. Number one, that we always like to have backup in halacha. If you watch the way that we're going to be doing mechiras chametz, everybody is invited. A day before Pesach, we're going to, you know, sit in the office down the hall, and we'll sit down with Mr. Sears, who always buys the chametz in Chicago every single year. And we're going to have five or six different ways of transferring the chametz to him, because we always like to have a fallback in case that something goes wrong with one of the transactions, so we have another transaction as well. So therefore, we always do a kinyan sudor. It's like you cannot have a Jewish ceremony without a kinyan sudor. It's just like it wouldn't be Jewish. So that's, you know, one reason. A second reason is that it creates, this is something that I find, it creates a sense of religious reverence. That the parties understand this isn't just appearing before any old arbitration tribunal. It's just like we have emblazoned on the wall behind the judge's bench in the Besdin room at the CRC. We have the words tzedek, tzedek, tir dope. You know, this is serious business. This is being done according to Torah law. There's a notion of Elokim nitzav adas keb, the kerev Elokim yishpot, that the divine presence rests upon the judges and rests upon a Besdin proceeding. So we want to instill that sense of fear of God in reverence into the parties, that they should understand that this is a very serious religious affair, and that they have religious obligations in terms of truth-telling, in terms of respect for the decorum of the proceedings, in terms of respect for divine justice, in terms of respect for the judges. That's always something that I appreciate. So once they have they do the Kinyan Suda, so it helps to facilitate and foster that atmosphere in the courtroom. So that's just another reason why it's good to have both. Okay, so let's move beyond the Shtar Beruin. One question that often is posed is, to what degree is it necessary for Bezdin, when it sends a summons, to spell out all of the particulars of the plaintiff's claim? So here we have a major dispute. Look in source Hay over here in the Shach. The Shach has a dispute with another authority named the Be'er Sheva. Okay, Be'er Sheva, also early authority, I think generation after the Sma. So the Be'er Sheva talks about a situation where Reuven summons Shimon and says, I want to put together a Din Torah. I have a claim against you. And Shimon says, well, I'm not going to enter into a Din Torah proceeding unless you tell me what claims you have against me. And Reuven says, I don't want to tell you until you show up. I don't want to give away the store. I don't want to give away what my tainus are, because then you'll have all this time to prepare yourself in terms of figuring out how to respond cleverly and creatively to my claims. I want to pounce upon you and surprise you, so I will have a better chance of winning. So the Be'er Sheva says that this makes sense, and he quotes the Gemara in Baba Basra. It says, that a person accustomed to not giving away all of their claims before they actually come to the Bezdin. So it sounds from the Gemara that it's legitimate. So says the Shach, that doesn't make sense to me. That's not what the Gemara means. What the Gemara means is that we have a general principle in Bezdin, that a person has made their claim in Bezdin, they can't come back the next day and say, I want to change my claim. That the claim, once it is rendered, then that's considered to have stuck. It's considered to be their final word, and they can't reverse what they had said previously. So he says that's what it means. However, the notion that a defendant should have the right to know when the plaintiff does come to Bezdin is certainly legitimate. It's just that what the Gemara meant is that if Reuven made certain claims outside of Bezdin before he came to Bezdin, and then once he steps into Bezdin, he wants to clarify or crystallize or even modify his claims a little bit, so then he has the right to do so. We don't have the principle of Kiman Shehigit Shuvein Chosim Umagid that he can't modify or edit his claims when he first set his claims outside of Bezdin. However, the notion that before you come to Bezdin, that Shimon should have some idea of what is being claimed against him, that certainly is perfectly legitimate. So it would seem from this that it's a machlokas between the Be'er Sheva and the Shach. So how would we paskin if we have a machlokas between the Be'er Sheva and the Shach? There's a general principle in Shulchan Aruch. Everyone who knows is a yeshiva student, is like a smicha, who's somebody who has a musmach, who's gone to yeshiva. So most people know that if there is kind of like a fight between the Shach and anybody else, the Shach usually wins. Okay, so the Shach is the major commentary in Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya, and the major commentary of Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat. And if there's a dispute between the Shach and the Sma, for example, so the Shach usually carries the day. Dispute in Yoredeya between the Shach and the Taz, the Shach usually carries the day. So really you would figure that the halakha is like the Shach, which means that a defendant has the right to know what's the claim that has been brought against him, which is what makes a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein kind of like a little bit surprising. If you look in the source Vav, this is Igros Moshe Choshen Mishpat Chelek Beis Siman Vav, so Rav Moshe Feinstein apparently had ruled on behalf of the Bezdin of Agudas of Rabbanim in Brooklyn, or New York City, Rav Moshe had ruled that they did not have an obligation to this, when they would send the hazmana, they would send the summons, it was sufficient for them to just send the summons to Shimon saying, Reuven has various monetary claims against you, you want to find out what they are, show up to our Bezdin on such and such date, and we will convene a proceeding, and you'll find out then. And the question was, is that considered to be legitimate? Ramosha said, yeah, that's 100% fine. So somebody wrote a letter to Ramosha saying, how could you say such a thing? That goes against the Shach. Do you mean that you're paskening like the Be'er Sheva against the Shach? Is that what you're doing? So says Ramosha, look in the second paragraph over here. He says, Be'etzem, He says, in reality, in principle, anu sofim kashach. In principle, of course, we hold like the shach, because I'm not going to tell you that we're not going to hold like the shach. We're going to disregard the shach in favor of the Be'er Sheva. He says, lemaise, pashut abar shaguda savabana, mishim bezin samchai, lo yishalcho asmano, lechad al tviyas tvar koton, shishayach li stopek, deshem ayinan nipa, mishalim la tovea, be'atzma, machma, shalgirtse, lelech medina medina. But he says that a Bezdin can be trusted that they would not have sent the Hazmana, they would not have sent the summons unless they came to the conclusion that this matter could not otherwise have been settled. What does Rav Moshe mean by that? If you go back to the Shach, okay, look at the last three lines of the Shach before you get to the Igros Moshe. He says, the Nippa has the right to say, tell me what you want, what claim you want to bring against me, Imi. Why? Because maybe when I find out what you want from me, I will abide by your claim. I'll pay up. We won't need to have a protracted litigation. And therefore, he doesn't have to come to the Din Torah, the Nitba, until the Nitba is told what the claim is, because maybe the whole Din Torah could have been avoided altogether. So it says Rav Moshe, so we see there's a reason for the ruling of the Shach, that the Din Torah could have been avoided altogether. But if the Beis Din comes to the conclusion that there's no way this could have been settled, a Beis Din can be trusted that it did its due diligence. It spoke to the plaintiff and, you know, got a sense as to whether this was something that could potentially be settled with the defendant. I don't know exactly how it came to that conclusion without speaking to the defendant, but the Beis Din came to that conclusion and therefore only sent the Hazmana once it determined that there was no way of making Shalom in this case. And Rav Moshe gives the second reason in the third paragraph. And the second reason Rav Moshe gives in the third paragraph is that sometimes it's clear to the Beis Din that the defendant knows exactly how much is being asked from him, and therefore it's not necessary to send a greater clarification or detailed specification. And not only that, but maybe the Beis Din's real goal in sending the Hazmana is that it wants to frighten the Nitba into being worried that they're going to have to deal with the litigation. So the mere fact, even without spelling out the claims, the mere fact the Nitba has received a letter in the mail will light a fire under the Nitba, that since he knows how much he really owes, so as a result of receiving the Hazmana, he'll pay up whatever it is that he was supposed to pay up. So that's the argument, that's the explanation Rav Moshe gave as to why he felt that it was not necessary to spell things out. Now, what I have found is that, generally speaking, there is a huge advantage in terms of actually spelling things out. And that is that, number one, if the amount actually is spelled out, you do have the shock's consideration that will make the Nitba more likely to say, oh, this is an amount that I think that I really owe, and therefore it's less likely to lead to litigation. I had a case like that where the Nitba, interestingly enough, was a towing, was somebody who served as a rabbinic advocate, and he was being sued by somebody to whom who had paid a retainer to him, and the person said that the retainer was based on there being a certain amount of work, and there wasn't nearly that amount of work, and therefore I'm entitled to a refund for a certain amount. And I called up the towing, because I knew the towings. I figured as a professional courtesy I would just call up before we send any hazmana, and he said, oh, fine, so let him spell out exactly how much he thinks I owe. I think I probably do owe him something, you know, now that I think about it. And when we sent the claim letter with an itemized explanation as to how much was owed, he said, yeah, that makes sense to me. And he just wrote a check and the whole case was resolved, which I think spoke very well of that particular rabbinic advocate. He didn't want the headache of having to be drawn into a Din Torah proceeding himself, and he just settled right away. So sometimes what the Shach says really actually happens. Secondly, if you ask people to spell out their claims, it also helps to prevent frivolous claims, because this way the people have to really show that there's something serious that has the possibility, the potential for relief in Beis Din. It enables the Beis Din to weed out certain types of claims where I would say if the standard in secular court would be that you would grant a motion to dismiss, because even if you assume the correctness of all the claims that were being asserted, this still wouldn't be enough to effectuate relief. So the best thing to just say, we're not going to take this case altogether. And if you didn't require the parties to spell out the claims, then the Beis Din wouldn't be able to weed out those types of frivolous claims from coming to the Beis Din altogether.
And civil arbitration laws don't require spelling out?
Not necessarily.
Like
no, as long as you get the parties to sign the arbitration agreement. The arbitration agreement itself would have to, you know, specify, once you have the parties in your courtroom and you're about to start litigating the case, so you can say at that point in time, okay, what is this about? The plaintiff could say, oh, it's about a landlord-tenant dispute relating to the property located at the following address. So you write in the Shtar B'Ruin, it's about a landlord-tenant dispute relating to the property of a certain address, and that's all you need for arbitration agreement purposes. But you can do that on the spot when the parties actually show up. But this, to me, is another advantage of spelling out the claims beforehand, namely that the Beis Din, I find that it's very efficient and useful for the Beis Din to have a signed arbitration agreement before the parties actually come to Beis Din. If you don't know the subject matter of the dispute, then the Beis Din doesn't have the ability to really frame an arbitration agreement. I mean, this was the CRC's practice for many years, was simply to send out a Shtar B'Ruin, having the names of the parties, and have them say, okay, there's a dispute, we agree to submit the dispute to the Beis Din and have them sign. It's not clear, as a matter of arbitration law, that's sufficient. You have to give, it could be a very generalized subject matter, but you need some sort of subject matter for the arbitration agreement, and then they would come in, and that we would elaborate upon that arbitration agreement by adding a more detailed description. But you would still have to supplement it. It's much easier and better and more efficient to have a clearly spelled out arbitration agreement before the parties come in. But there's another reason why it's very, very important for the Beis Din itself to understand all of the details of the claim, and that is that the Beis Din can determine who are the right parties to the dispute. So the Beis Din can then make sure that all of the necessary parties to the dispute have signed on to the arbitration agreement, and that you don't have an arbitration agreement that misses a very important party, for example. But these are all good reasons why the Beis Din needs to know all of the details of the claim. But what about in terms of sharing it with the other party? So there you go back to the notion, number one, that maybe that will help to facilitate settlement. Number two, it also helps to increase a sense of faith in the Beis Din system, that a person feels that they have an adequate ability to prepare for defending themselves and for answering and for being able to assert any possible counterclaims. It's very difficult to expect somebody to respect the process when they don't feel respected themselves in terms of just being told ahead of time of the nature of the claims. What is it that a plaintiff could legitimately be worried about? So that's what Ramosha was sort of alluding to, and the Be'er Sheva was alluding to. What a person could be legitimately worried about is that they're going to give all of their claims in painstaking detail, and then the defendant is just going to know kind of everything that they're going to argue, but will not actually show up to the Beis Din, and that just gives them kind of an additional leg up on being able to figure out different ways of getting out of their obligations before there's any kind of court action or anything else that the plaintiff would be able to do in terms of really reining in this individual who they feel, you know, owes money to them and so forth. So one thing that's very important is that there be a balanced treatment of both parties by the Beis Din. In other words, that if it really does increase the trust in the Beis Din and the legitimacy of the process to require, just like you would in a court proceeding, for there to be an elaboration of all of the claims on the part of the plaintiff, then there, and that the defendant should be able to see that. By the same token, the plaintiff should be able to see what the response is from the defendant. Now realize that unlike a regular court case, you don't have that automatic ability in an arbitration proceeding, because until the parties have actually signed on the dotted line that they're giving jurisdiction to the Beis Din, a defendant can write a response to the hazmana, to the summons that was sent by the plaintiff, and say to the Beis Din, I don't want this shared with the other party. I'm giving you this confidential response. And then it's a little bit unfair, because the plaintiff had to share all of their, you know, claims and considerations with the defendant, but the defendant is writing to the Besdin and saying, oh, don't share my response with the plaintiff. I just want you to look at my response as to why I feel that I'm not obligated or I don't have to go to Besdin, but don't tell the plaintiff what it is that I said. So there's something wrong about that. So how do you fix that? So the way in which we've tried to fix that in the Besdin is to include in the Hazmana letter, in the summons letter that goes out from the Besdin says, here's the claim letter from the plaintiff that we're sending to you, the defendant, and we want you to submit to our Besdin or submit to a different Besdin as the case may be. But please be advised that any response that you render to the Besdin shall be shared with the other party. You know, it's just a disclosure so the person knows. If they don't respond at all, so fine, so we'll just announce the person didn't respond at all. But they are put on notice that whatever, they're not allowed to say this is that we're rendering a response that it has to be kept confidential. We will treat that as if it is not a response at all. And by the way, Batei Din have gotten into trouble for this sort of thing, because when Batei Din have not spelled that out from the beginning and then they're put in this awkward position where a defendant renders a confidential response, they have to figure out how do they convey the substance of what of the discussions that are taking place with the plaintiff without violating the confidentiality of the defendant. A plaintiff could then have a taina, could have a legitimate complaint against the Besdin later on. Oh, you rejected my case. You rejected my complaint, and I wasn't even given the ability to respond to whatever the defendant said to you because that wasn't shared with me. And I have seen that happen. So it's very, very important to avoid that. So in that sense, that is one legitimate argument that a plaintiff might make as to why they wouldn't want to share every single detail of their claim with the defendant. But certainly the basic outline of the case should be shared with the defendant based upon this principle of the Shach, that there should be at least some sort of an ability for the defendant to know what is being claimed against him or her and to prepare themselves for the Din Torah and also to prepare any possible counterclaims. Yes?
If the plaintiff is going to call witnesses, is that something that can be hidden or can be revealed?
If the let's say that the parties are planning to that the parties are planning to bring witnesses, so is that something that should be shared with the Besdin? So we generally do require that to be shared with the Besdin. Yes. Okay. Now let me just move along because we have how much time do we have? We have 15 minutes. Okay. What about then in terms of spelling things out when it comes time for the Besdin to issue a decision? Does the Besdin have to issue a decision? Very interestingly, under arbitration law, there is no requirement for an arbitration tribunal to spell out all of the reasons for their decision. And in fact, the less that they spell out the reasons for their decision, the less likely they are to get overturned, curiously enough. So there's almost like a disincentive to be completely candid with the parties regarding the reason for the decision. In fact, there's a Besdin that I know. It's a very, very fine Besdin that might have very extensive reasons as to why they issue a psak, but they'll keep the reasons within their own file and within their internal records, but won't share it with the parties for precisely this reason, because their experience has shown them that the less that they spell things out, the better, the less likely that the parties will be able to challenge their decision in court in terms of being able to overturn the decision. That reminds me, there was a case, I think, in the Second Circuit a couple of years ago of a Besdin that heard a proceeding, and one of the parties wanted to overturn the Besdin decision based on the claim that one of the judges had exercised a lack of impartiality, as had been evidenced through the give and take that took place during the proceedings. So the court said, okay, well, let's review a transcript of the proceedings and we'll determine whether the court acted in such a way that it evidenced the lack of impartiality. And it turned out that there was no transcript of the proceedings, that they just didn't, you know, record it or tape it or anything. And it wasn't, you know, necessary under arbitration law. As long as there were good notes that are taken for the proceeding, that's considered to be good enough. So the court said, well, you know, maybe if we had listened to a recording, we would have found, you know, some sort of a problem. But there was no recording, so therefore we can't overturn, you know, the verdict. Now, it happens that we record every single one of our proceedings and we make a transcript available to the parties upon request, because we feel that it's just very important to be upfront and to be as transparent as possible. But if the goal is to ensure enforceability, it's very interesting and kind of make me a little bit counterintuitive that the way that the law works is that the less transparency, then the more likely the decision is going to be upheld. Very, very interestingly. So what does halakha require, though? If secular law doesn't require spelling out the reasons, does halakha itself require spelling it out anyway? So the answer is, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, this is the source Zion, the Siman Yudalit, Sif Dalit, it depends. That there are two circumstances in which the reasons have to be spelled out. One is b'makom chashad, when there's reason for the parties legitimately to feel that the Beis Din was not fair-minded with them. There's something about the decision that makes them suspicious that the Beis Din was showing favoritism to the other side. This is based on a story in the Gemara. This is the Gemara in Baba Metzia. We look in source attests on the next page that there were two people who had an iska, they had a business with each other, and that they were partners with each other, and they had a certain amount of money that they made, and one partner, Reuven, split the money of the partnership without telling Shimon, and then Shimon complained to Rapapa, who is the Dayan, and Rapapa said, money is money. What difference does it make whether you got this type of coin or that type of coin? You got the same amount of money that he got, so he's allowed to split it not in your presence, so therefore he ruled in favor of Reuven. And then, a year later, Shimon decided that he's going to split the assets of the partnership. They had a certain amount of wine, and he split the wine that he gave, a certain amount of wine to himself and a certain amount of wine to Reuven, and Reuven complained. So they went in front of Rapapa, and Rapapa said, once again, I'm ruling in favor of Reuven, that Shimon had no right to split the assets of the partnership because certain wine might be better than other wine. So in this case, Papa said that I have to spell out the reasons for my decision to Shimon, because Shimon will think I'm discriminating against him. Then when he split the assets, then when Reuven split the assets, I said Reuven was right. And when Shimon split the assets, he said that Reuven was right. So in both cases, Reuven was right, regardless of who split the assets. So therefore, it would look like he was showing favoritism to Reuven. And therefore, he had to explain that everyone knows that coins are coins regardless of what quality the coins happen to be. They all are, they're worth the same amount of value. They're fungible. But when it comes to wine, since the ikab de basim, ikab de lo basim, some wine is a better quality, is more flavorful, is more, has a better aroma, than other wine. And therefore, you can't split the wine barrels without both partners being present and being able to participate in the process. So therefore, on the basis of that Gemara, we rule that whenever there is the possibility of a kashad, the Besdin has to spell out their reasons. A second type of case, this is based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Aleph, is if the Besdin compels one of the parties to come in front of the Besdin. So whenever there's compulsion, so the party who is compelled can say, well, once you issue your decision, I want a written capitulation of that decision so that I can have it reviewed by a higher court, by a Besdin, a Godla. I wanted to have the ability to have it reviewed. And both of these reasons are codified in the Shulchan Aruch. But there is the Piskei Tshuva, which is source Ches, gives a certain distinction between the two reasons. You can turn over to page 3, and the Piskei Tshuva says that in terms of writing down the reasoning, it says writing down the reasoning is only required in the event that the Beis Din had compelled one of the parties to come. When it is a question of chashad, of just one party doesn't fully trust the Beis Din, so then the Beis Din is only under an obligation to verbally explain why it is that they ruled a particular way, but there is no inherent basis for a party that's suspicious of the Beis Din. We assume that the Beis Din is not objectively acting in a suspicious way. There's no inherent right that a party has to bring that decision and have it reviewed by an appellate court. So therefore, it doesn't have to be written down. However, it says the Piskei Tshuva that in the event, that if it was done through compulsion, then the Beis Din has to write it down, but they don't have to write down the reasons, because since there's no suspicion about the Beis Din, it's just that the Beis Din had compelled one party to come, therefore that party has the right to appeal the decision in front of a higher court. So all the Beis Din has to write down is these were the claims and this was my decision, and this was our decision, but the Beis Din does not have to give the reasons. The only time the Beis Din has to both write down the case and also give the reasons in writing for their decision is when you have both. when the Beis Din had compelled one party to show up in front of it, and there also is reason for suspicion based on the way in which the verdict was crafted by the Beis Din, only then does the Beis Din have to, number one, explain its reasoning, and number two, put the reasoning in writing, only in that confluence of circumstances. Who decides that it's suspicious? So if it's along the lines of what the Gemara talks about, where it seems that the Beis Din is being inconsistent in its rulings in favor of one party against the other party, so something like that would be viewed as suspicious. You'd have to figure out, you know, what else would fall into that category. But you look in the last source that we have, which is the Yabia Omer, the Hebrew source, that's Rav Avadya Yosef. Ravaya Yosef is explaining the justification for having appellate courts nowadays. He's talking about in the Beis Din in Israel, the justification for the appellate court system. So he says in typical humorous fashion, he was a funny person, Ravaya Yosef, more than people realize, he had a good sense of humor. So he said that I'm going to explain, you know, why it is that we have an appellate process, even though this decision itself might be subject to appellate review. It's not so clear, according to halakha, how you can always allow for an appellate process. So he says the following things. He says, first of all, although we have a principle in halakha, the Beis Din acha Beis Din lo daiki, one Beis Din doesn't examine another Beis Din, he says that's just a minhag, that's just a general custom, but if there is reason to examine a Beis Din's decision, of course it should be examined. Number two, he says that really all that means is that we don't hear all of the claims of the parties over again, but the actual decision can be reviewed by another Beis Din, especially a Beis Din of higher standard. Number three, he says that now that the right to have a decision put in writing so it can be reviewed by another Beis Din is whenever parties are compelled to show up in front of Beis Din. Even nowadays, sometimes we compel a party to show up in front of a Beis Din, right? I mean, if you threaten to issue a seiruv against a party, unless they show up, you say we're going to issue a contempt order, and only on that basis they show up, even if they sign an arbitration agreement, on some level, that is still considered to be compulsion. Number four, he says that according to he quotes the Beis Yosef in the Avkas Rochel. He says that nowadays, even if there is no compulsion, every single Beis Din is considered to be a chashid. Every Beis Din, people don't trust Bati Din. They think Bati Din have it out for them, so therefore you can always assume that there is like a built-in suspicion. Number five, the Noda Behuda says that whenever people have to be invited to come to Beis Din, even if a person agrees, a defendant, when he gets the summons, agrees to come to Beis Din, nonetheless, if he had to be invited, that's considered to be kfiya. That's considered to be forced. Number six, he says, nowadays, Bati Din aren't as good necessarily as they used to be. He says, nowadays, people make mistakes all the time, and therefore, it's proper to write down one's reasoning so that it can be subject to meticulous review and scrutiny because there is the possibility of mistake. Number seven, that a Beis Din, even if they don't have to write down their decisions, they should want to be above reproach and above board, and to show how confident they are that they really did a good job, of course they should write it down. If they don't want to write it down, that itself is suspicious. Number eight, he says that since nowadays we live in a world where people expect there to be some sort of an appellate process, so therefore that's part of what they're bargaining for. When a person goes to an arbitration court, they expect to have the rights of appellate review and of all the reasoning written down, and therefore you have to accommodate their requests. Number nine, he says that, and this is a question because he assumes that the more things are written down, the more professionally it's done, the more likely you'll be able to enforce the decision. As we pointed out, it could also potentially work the other way as well. Number ten, he says that if a mistake was made, so it's a mitzvah rabba for the Beis Din to write down their reasoning, so that the right judgment can eventually be rendered in case they did make a mistake. Number 11, he says that that nowadays, even though there was a dispute, there was a dispute between the Beis Yosef and the Ribosh regarding whether we say, as to whether we say Beis Din Basa Beis Din Lo Daiki is only a concept in the Gemara, or is a concept even today. And the Beis Yosef said it's a concept even today, and the Radbaz says, no, nowadays we don't trust Bati Din as much. So he said, even if in the days of the Beis Yosef, we still apply the principle of Beis Din Basa Beis Din Lo Daiki, and even if that principle means that we never question the judgment of a Beis Din, he says, that bizman hazeh efshe shegam maran yodeh la'aradbaz ki talonu me'od. That nowadays, that we have become less proficient and less expert, that even the Beis Yosef, who had said that that principle still applies, maybe nowadays we shouldn't be so high and mighty, and we have to be a little bit more humble about our abilities as a bezdin. So for all these reasons, he's very much in favor. So I'll just conclude with the very last source, which is a case, Lang versus Levy. Lang versus Levy was a case where the bezdin of America had issued an appellate decision, where the parties, it was a husband and wife, had come to the bezdin. The wife wanted to receive a certain money based on the prenuptial agreement that said she's entitled to a certain money, amount of money every single day for as long as the couple was separated, and the bezdin issued a large amount of money to the wife. And the husband said, what was the purpose of the prenuptial agreement? That I wouldn't make her an aguna. The second she asked me for a get, I gave her a get. I didn't know that she's counting the days where we were separated, that she wants to get money for every single one of those days. So I don't think I should have to pay her, because it's like an implied waiver. She never asked for the money until after I gave her the get. Then suddenly she asked for the money for the 3 months or so that we were separated. So the case was brought to appeal based on the Bezdin's appellate rules that ruled that it could be brought to an appellate judge. And it was brought to Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who was the Sagana Bezdin of the Bezdin of America, and he reversed the lower court decision. So then the wife went to the law, this Court of Special Appeals of Maryland, and said, what right did he have to appeal the verdict of the Bezdin? And the court ruled that the appellate decision of the Bezdin was in fact valid, for two reasons. Number one, because the parties signed in their arbitration agreement that they agreed to abide by the rules and procedures of the Bezdin, which gave the appellate power to the Bezdin itself, which shows that while there can be appellate review even in the secular court system, for a Bezdin to really be able to retain its jurisdiction throughout the process, it's very smart for a Bezdin to say, yes, there could be appellate review, but we're going to conduct the appellate review and put that in the rules and procedures. And number two, because it was basically an ecclesiastical decision, the secular court was not going to interfere with whatever the decision was, as long as it didn't shock the conscience, and they felt that it was perfectly reasonable to have found waiver under the circumstances. So we find that having an appellate process is something that does build up confidence in people in the Bezdin process, and part of that as well is the notion that it is so certainly appropriate, particularly in this day and age when people really need to be able to restore their faith in the Bezdin system, for the Bezdin to spell out their reasoning and their analysis and as detailed a possible, detailed a fashion as possible, so that people can really understand and appreciate what the Bezdin is all about, and hopefully, you know, others can read the decisions and also have greater faith in participating in the Bezdin process.
Yeah. Sorry? Oh.